Lecture 7, From Causewayed Camps to Henges.
Let's get down and take a more detailed look at the Avery complex of Neolithic monuments. From the long barrows which cluster in that area of northern Wiltshire, to the Windmill Hill Causewayed Camp, atop a hill with excellent lines of sight reaching many, many miles, to the charnel house named the Sanctuary by the enthusiastic 18th century antiquarian William Stukeley, the Druidomain, to the huge conical mound known as Silbury Hill, to the deep ditches and steep banks of the great henge on which the village of Avebury was built in the Middle Ages. Within that henge, three circles of upright stones were erected. On from there, let's go to the avenues. Parallel standing stones, which curved out from the henge, one of them connecting the henge to the sanctuary, that charnel house. Before listing in chronological sequence and describing these monuments, I'd like to take a look at the five or six territories, each centered on a causewayed camp henge sequence, which Paul Ashby has discerned in the Neolithic landscape of south central England. All of them together constituted some kind of a large territorial entity, but essentially culturally unified territorial entity, which Ashby likes to call Wessex. Now, this is an anachronism, of course, but a provocatively interesting one, which suggests some of the kinds of continuity that scientific archaeologists even have discovered in the remains of the Windmill Hill culture and its Bronze Age successor, now generally called the Wessex culture. Now, several current British writers like to speak of the territory of the Windmill Hill culture as Wessex. Now, this is, of course, a terrible anachronism. Writers who do so, and who apply that term, that name to that Neolithic culture zone, are using the name of a Saxon kingdom established in the 5th century CE by Germanic invaders, a name which faded from general usage after the Norman conquest of the 11th century. Now, one element of the resonance of the name Wessex for modern readers and writers of English, not only British ones, I think, is the use of that name in the works of Thomas Hardy, the great novelist, who described the landscape and social mores of that part of south central England very powerfully and very painfully in such novels as The Mayor of Casterbridge, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, his most widely read one and the one most directly relevant to Stonehenge anyway, and Jude the Obscure. So the name seems useful to me, the name Wessex, so long as we recognize how shamelessly anachronistic it is. It does suggest an underlying continuity, an idea which is sympathetic to much current thought about long-term patterns of European history and society. In his book, The Ancient British, the English archaeologist Paul Ashby develops his notion of five or six Wessex territories in Neolithic times. He says six, but I only really count five. I mean, one of them is hardly a separate territory, I think. Anyway, each of these, let's say roughly half dozen territories, was centered in Ashby's notion on a causewayed camp, the center of several long barrowed communities, constituting the territory of a people, a tribe, whatever you want to call it. And eventually, from each of these causewayed camps, a henge is developed. And Ashby ranks these according to size. The northernmost, and perhaps the first of these henge complexes, as well as certainly the most monumental, is the complex that radiates out from the causewayed camp of Windmill Hill. And from that great causewayed camp, the henge of Avebury would be developed on a site halfway between the top of Windmill Hill and the River Kennet, which flows from just about that point to the east beneath it, joining up with the Thames eventually, a river with a very interesting kind of name, a name which is pre-Indo-European and like Sarum may suggest something about the earlier significance of that place in the minds of these early Neolithic people. Now, this, according to Ashby, is a class one site, which for Ashby means it covers between 13 and 21 acres. But, of course, any of these measurements depend on how many subsidiary elements of the complex you want to include. I mean, there are the barrows, you don't include those, but the causewayed camp, the henge is close. What about other things, like, for example, freestanding mounds or cursuses, things that look like racetracks, should they be included or not? And so this measurement, Ashby is here trying to be an archaeological scientist, so we have three or four classes of these things depending on size, but what do you include? It's something of a subjective judgment, of course. Well, geographically next to the Windmill Hill Avebury complex is a very small causewayed camp overlooking the Vale of Pewsey, the valley of the River Pewsey, still in the county of Wiltshire, known as Knaphill. Knaphill is a class 4 site covering only 3 to 5 acres, depending on how you calculate it. South of Knapp Hill, beyond the River Pusey, still in Wiltshire, is a Class 3 site, a 5 to 8 acre site called Robin Hood's Ball. What a wonderful name, especially for anyone with folkloric enthusiasms. Many people who are interested in folklore decide that folklore holds the key to the deep past, and that the legend of Robin Hood, this remarkable man who not only stole from the rich to give to the poor, but who was a noble and earl's son and had other quasi-sacral functions, it would appear, may have been the name of some great priest or king or chief or something of this area. I don't think there's any kind of basis for that, but it's the kind of enthusiasm which the desire to find long roots of continuity in the English public has given rise to. Now, the hinge which would evolve from that camp downhill towards the River Avon is Stonehenge, the most sophisticated hinge of all, one of the smallest, but infinitely, far and away, the most sophisticated. According to Ashby's reckoning, the Robin Hood's Ball Stonehenge complex served as the communal center for a very large Neolithic people, which counted 111 long barrow-based communities in its number, in its rank. It also holds, as you can see, if you look at a map of this area, a kind of a central position between the original heavy Windmill Hill, Causeway Camp territory to the north, and then other territories south of it. Just south, or southwest, actually, of Robinhood Ball Stonehenge is the White Cheat Hill Causeway Camp, another Class 3 site, which serviced a much smaller community. So we have a Class 3 site, Robin Hood's Ball, which produced the most sophisticated of all of the henges and has 111 barrow groups involved in it. And then we have another Class 3 site, which serviced a much smaller community. Moving south still, now across the Wiltshire County line, towards the county of Dorset, is Hambledon Hill. This is a very large Class 1 site, servicing a sizable number of long barrow communities and has some very strange other kinds of earthworks in the area. The southernmost of these Wessex territories is that of Maiden Castle, just off the Dorset coast. This is a large Class 1 site, and it's named for the huge Iron Age hill fort, which was erected on the site of the camp and the camp's hinge, and then captured by the Romans in the first century of our era after a famous siege excavated by the great Mortimer Wheeler, who found Roman projectiles, little Roman lead balls which were flung by slings, which were deadly if they struck you, and some of them embedded in bones, and I think an arrowhead embedded in the bone of a Celtic defender and so on. Very, very dramatic siege presented on BBC television early on. The city of Dorchester grew up beneath that imposing site, and today Dorchester has grown up around Maiden Castle. It's an extraordinary site to visit. Now, of these, we notice that Knapp Hill, White Sheet Hill, and Hambledon Hill are all situated on the crest of chalky downland, overlooking a river valley. Windmill Hill and Robinhood Ball are further away from the rivers Avon or Kennet or whatever. Aubrey Burrell has revised Ashby's insight in his remarkable book, The Stonehenge People. Burrell discerns four great regions of Neolithic Wessex. He says five, but I can only find four in his map. I wonder if we have a proofreading problem right here. And most of these regions of Burrell's overlap with Ashby's territories. Region 1, Burrell calls the Marlborough Downs, which includes Windmill Hill Avebury and Knapp Hill. To its south is the Salisbury Plain region, including Ashby's Robin Hood's Ball Stonehenge and the White Sheet Hill territories. And directly south of the Salisbury Plain region is the Cranbourne Chase region, stretching from the Hambledon Hill Causeway Camp eastward to the Avon River. To the south of that, along the coast of the English Channel, is the Dorset Downs region, identical with Ashby's Maiden Castle territory. These are two different ways of looking at basically the same phenomenon. What both of these authors feel is that in the 3rd and 2nd millennia BCE, large and self-conscious communities, which were capable of undertaking constructions that required well-coordinated labor and other expensive resources and lots of sheer engineering talent, were capable also of maintaining these projects through long stretches of time, existed in the territory of the Windmill Hill culture. The most monumental and the most varied of these Neolithic territorial complexes, and perhaps the earliest of them, is Windmill Hill Avebury, Ashby's term, which Burrell prefers to call the Marlborough Downs region. Now, what is a henge? I postponed the definition of a henge until this point. A henge is an earthwork, circular or roughly circular. The earlier ones are more roughly circular. The later ones, like Stonehenge, are quite perfectly circular. It consists of a ditch and a bank. Ditch and bank together equal a henge. The idea of a henge arose from carpentry language. A hinge is a hinge on which a door swings, or you can also speak about the lintel of a door as a hinge as well. And early English carpenters were struck by the stone hinges as opposed to wood hinges found at that remarkable place, which they then called Stonehenge, with a kind of English common sense about it. But the term hinge is curious, somewhat in the way that Causeway Camp is curious, but no one's come up with a better one, so we stick with hinge at this point. But it is an earthwork, having nothing to do with any kind of carpentry, at least originally. And it consists of a ditch and a bank. The bank is often outside the ditch, which shows that the construction has no military purpose. If you want to set up a wall with a moat, you make sure that the wall is inside the moat, right? And the moat is between the wall and the enemy. But instead, many of these hinges have walls outside the moat, which would give any attacker tremendous firepower advantage, as well as a basic reconnaissance advantage over anybody inside of it. So it, like a Causeway Camp, just simply has no military function. Sometimes the ditch is deep and the embankment is high, as is remarkably the case at Avery. I'll talk more about that in just a little bit. Sometimes, as a Stonehenge, they're minimal, just enough to define what we now tend to see as sacred space, and what almost certainly the Neolithic constructors saw as sacred space. Also, a notion that we can, I think with some reasonable probability, assume we share with them. Now, the space within the circle of the henge, it was usually equipped with buildings of some sort. Woodhenge, east of Stonehenge, had parallel rows of wooden posts within the ditch, very likely roofed over with thatch. Thatch derived from wheat straw. Stonehenge, which gave this type of monument its name, has and had several rings of stones within the ditch, as well as originally a circle of 56 wooden poles. Aubrey Burl is convinced that originally there was a wooden structure. In fact, in different stages of Stonehenge, two different wooden structures, both of them rectangular, which would be quite different, and the purpose of those has been much disputed. Now, the Windmill Hill Avery complex was constructed over 8 centuries in many stages. Now, I'd like to follow Aubrey Burl's conclusions. It's published in a wonderful book called Prehistoric Avebury, published by the Yale Press in 1979. I think it's a splendid book and a very unusual book in which a professional archaeologist is willing to take tremendous flights of speculative imagination as he tries to come up with explanations which the generally educated public can enjoy and read. As he points out, the different stages are, first of all, involve the long barrows. First came the long barrows, of which the largest in the immediate area is the West Kennet Long Barrow. This is the longest of the long barrows of southern Britain, in fact. It's situated on the crest of the chalky ridge which parallels the Kennet to the south of that stream. You've got here Windmill Hill. South of it is the Kennet, and then the land rises again. There's a ridge, and on this ridge, looking over at Windmill Hill, over the valley of the Kennet, is the West Kennet Long Barrow. Its oldest part was laid out around 4000 BCE, again with ditches on either side, ditches from which chalk was dug, but certainly not nearly enough chalk to build up the vast mass of this tremendously long barrow. It seems to have been used for the last time around 2250 for the burial of one of the new peoples in this area, the Beaker people. Right up at the eastern end is the burial of a person with a beaker, a pottery beaker. And that beaker, which once accompanied that person's bones, is now in the Keeler Museum at Avebury. The Keeler Museum is wonderful because it projects the memory of Alexander Keeler, heir of the Keeler Marmalade fortune, a great enterprise. And what this gentleman of great leisure and a great wealth did with that wealth was to become a very serious amateur archaeologist, a contemporary of Gordon Child, living about almost exactly the same generation. Keeler was much in touch with him and with other archaeologists, but he himself simply dug. He bought up most of the village of Avebury, buying the land, and then he would hire crews who would work on identifying the great stones which had fallen, the great stone from the three great stone circles within the henge. And those which had fallen, he had put up again. Some people question that. When it was a sign that a stone had been there, but instead had been smashed up, he would have little concrete pylons put in to indicate its particular location. And he stopped his work in 1939. Everything in Britain stopped in 1939 for overwhelming exterior reasons, and never resumed it. But he left a considerable endowment, and the Keeler Museum is there to honor his memory. We'll be talking about various of his interpretations as we go on with this. The eastern end of this great West Kennet long barrow, which is almost due east, contains five burial chambers constructed of, faced by huge stones. And the whole thing is faced and closed off with even larger megaliths. Now, all of these big stones were dragged from the Marlborough Downs 1 or 2 miles to the east. Not that far. You've got to go down the down, up the Kennet, up into the valley of the Kennet, and then haul your stone up again, which was a major achievement. We'll be talking more about that later on. After 3100 BCE, no new long barrows seem to have been begun. So 4,000, 3100 is the range of the long barrows, the immediate area of Windmill Hill. But Paul Ashby would like to associate with the Windmill Hill territory the Lambourne Long Barrow and the Wayland Smithy Long Barrow that I keep talking about, which are far away to the northeast of the territory. They, of course, are older, 4340, 3700, the Wayland Smithy rebuilt in 3400. But 300 years after the rebuilding in megalithic style of Wayland Smithy, no more long barrows. That day is over. Next comes the Causewayed Camp era. And Burrell estimates that the first ring of ditches up on Windmill Hill seems to have been dug about 3,000. You've got about a century here. The long barrows are still perfectly able to contain people who die, since, after all, only a few selected people are buried in them, although many bones are buried in the West Kennet Long Barrow. In fact, you have one chamber for men, actually two chambers for men, one for women, one for children. There are some members of these other groups in each of these, but predominantly two male chambers, one female, one chamber for children, and so on. They could continue to accommodate whatever individuals were chosen to be buried there. What the fact that no new ones are built may suggest a population freeze, right? That the expansion of these communities into new territory now requires a really serious colonization effort that takes the people out of the territory. That the population has met the limits of the land, and there's a kind of fixity involved. Something's got to be done. And what has to be done is the Causewayed Camp. Perhaps a little later than the first use of Windmill Hill as a ceremonial site, but maybe very, very close to it. In other words, right there around 3000. The first of a series of round houses was erected at the site known since the 18th century as the Sanctuary, off to the southeast. If here is Windmill Hill, over here is the Sanctuary. The Sanctuary was built right close to the Ridgeway Path, as the Ridgeway Path descends from the Marlborough Downs to the Kennet River. Now, the Ridgeway Path is a wonderful construction. It's not a construction, it's a highway, it's a road. It's a pathway which has been in use since about 3500 BCE, about the time that the Downs were definitively deforested. In fact, the Downs have more forest on them now, thanks to post-World War II planting, than they have had for thousands of years. And this was a major highway used for foot traffic, for trade, for lots of other forms of communication. It was abandoned when the Romans drove these straight highways through Britain, but then once the Romans were gone, people went back to things like Ridgeway paths, and still in use today as a footpath, a riding path, a rough road for the occasional jeep or farm tractor, or other kind of farm vehicle. And, of course, for walkers. Britain is a country of walkers. There are public paths marked out that you can follow, and all sorts of... It's a basic part of the culture. Archaeologists are now convinced that the timber roundhouses with conical thatched roofs, first a small one, then a larger one, then a larger one, not the larger ones were enclosing the smaller ones, it was rebuilt and rebuilt and torn down, and, you know, of wood rots and the thatch decays. It was redesigned several times over the 1,000 years of its use. This, instead of being a sanctuary where the Druids lived, as Stukeley thought, Stukeley managed to see Druids everywhere, we're now convinced that these were charnel houses, or mortuary houses, structures in which human cadavers would be laid out to decay until their cleaned bones were ready to be gathered for transport to a long barrow. We said something like this in Châtel-Houyuk, where the ancestors were somehow lost their flesh, and the bones were gathered together and wrapped in kiln-like rugs, you say, and then deposited under the beds. This excarnation, this technique called excarnation, which began in the Near East and may have been brought west as part of the Southwest Asian legacy of the European Neolithic. It was also practiced by many American Indians. I think the Cheyenne were, wasn't it, would put their dead up on racks and allow the birds and natural processes of decay to clean the bones and so on. These would remain very sacred kind of places. Now, charnel houses, which were found by the English colonists in Virginia In the 17th century, they were used by the Powhatan Indians around here, and other various other communities in North America also practiced this kind of burial technique. Charnel houses are deeply creepy places, even if they are part of your culture. They qualify absolutely for the proper definition of taboo. They are sacred and they are to be avoided, except on certain times by certain people. Burrell recounts the practice still active, one is told, or still active sort of 20 years ago when he was writing this book, 20 and 25 years ago when he was writing this book, in which certain privileged upper-class communities in of native South Africans, Zulus, to use the loose and inaccurate term for them, when a man of sufficient standing to have a polygamous family dies, then excarnation is practiced by these people, and it is the privilege of the senior wife, the number one wife, and her children, especially her eldest child, her eldest son, to go with the corpse of dad to the charnel house and to anoint it with different fluids and oils and so on. And they have to keep doing this for several days until the jaw drops off. Now, once it's argued by those who think that we do have a few instincts, that not everything is learned, that humans have two instincts, one of which is avoidance of snakes, which we share with our cousins, the chimpanzees, and so on. And the other one is horror of the smell of decaying human flesh, even if we don't know what it is. And other things smell as bad, but there's something that freaks out the human being, and this is understandable. We know, yeah, that elephants get very upset as they pass near one of those elephant graveyards where elephants go to die, and all this kind of thing. It's interesting, too. I mean, one of the first pieces of the body to go are the tendons that hold the jaw to the rest of the skull. And when the jaw drops, wife and children can take off from the charnel house. They fulfill their taboo function. And, I don't know, go into some deeply air-conditioned place, possibly for a few days, heavy use of perfume. But one of the interesting things to me is the number of funeral monuments of the early modern era of the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries in England, which show you not the standard skull of most of European iconography, but a skull without a jaw. Ha. Huh. Charnel houses were known on the continent as well, but they were particularly strong in this kind of Neolithic British construction. Well, to get away from this somewhat unappetizing topic, let's move to Silbury Hill, which is south of Windmill Hill, north of the West Kennet, between the West Kennet Long Barrow down here and Windmill Hill. It rises from the marshes in which the River Kennet takes its rise, an extraordinary, huge, conical mound. It's been known as Silbury Hill for a long time because of folklore, which was convinced that something like that had to be a burial mound. And there were much smaller round barrows all over, which everybody knew contained important men or women. So this must be the burial mound of King Sil, who English peasants knew was seated, mounted upon his golden horse somewhere in the depth of Silbury Hill. In the 18th century, a duke commissioned a group of Welsh miners to go down, to dig down there and find King Sil. They didn't find anything. And now it's been very thoroughly excavated and no one has found any signs of any kind of burial in it. So it's a very great mystery. And it's mysterious and extraordinary in a number of ways. Burrell thinks that it got going in the 28th century BCE, perhaps as close as 2750. We could even date the seasons of the year in which this extraordinary thing was built. I'll give you some statistics about it in a later lecture, which really, really boggle the mind. And he suspects it was completed rather swiftly, before too long after roughly 2750. There's a wonderful author named Michael Dames, who's written two books explaining the whole business of Avebury, and one of them is called the Silbury Treasure. And he is firmly convinced that this great conical mound was meant to represent the pregnant womb of the Earth Mother. Two circles of the hands are either her eyes or her breasts, I forget. And, you know, and all of this is this primal kind of Earth Mother Goddess kind of scene. And this is far from the weirdest of the theories that Avebury has provoked. Avebury is a wonderful source of theoretical creativity. It was built up of several layers of wedge-shaped sections, each of which was defined by a wall of large chalk blocks. Imagine pie slices. Imagine several pies, each one of them smaller than the other, built up. And each of the layers of pie has its own slices. Each of these slices is a wall of big blocks of chalk, see? And there's a big surrounding pie crust, if you want, of big chalk blocks. Inside, lots of little chalk rubble and other things are thrown. So it is a great deposit mound, a superior, spectacular version of the kind of deposit mound that Long Barrow's are. The spaces were filled with all kinds of things, rubble of various kinds, which has been analyzed. Most of it was chalk, though. Very little was just simply mud or very few animal bones or tools and so on. It's now covered by green grass, of course. But it was of course, originally gleaming white, visible for miles up and down the Kennet Valley, rising up to the level of the local hills. And it must have been quite an extraordinary sight. It is the largest man-made mound in Europe. It is even larger in cubic mass than the Great Pyramid at Giza in Egypt, which nobody will believe until you confront them with the figures. And the Great Pyramid of Giza is, incidentally, about 2 centuries younger. Now, this is the kind of evidence established by carbon-14 analysis of things like antler picks and other organic material that was in the mound, which undercuts the diffusionist theory of Gordon Child and many other people very profoundly. It's not that people off in the west of Britain had heard about the Great Pyramid, or an Egyptian had come who'd seen pyramids and tried to help them do this in their own crude, chalky kind of way. This is a separate idea. All things did not flow from the east to the west, all ideas. Then, of course, came the ditch and embankment of the hedge proper with its 3 stone circles. 2 circles of huge upright Sorsen stones from the Marlborough Downs are encircled in turn by an outer circle of even larger stones, which rises just beyond the inner cusp of the ditch. There's the bank, the ditch, the inner cusp, and here's this large circle of stones, and then there are 2 circles within it, and there are other stones set up within them. Burl argues that the ditch, bank, and stone circles were begun around 2600 BCE and completed with relative speed, maybe 3 or 4 short-lived generations. Burl likes the idea of rapid conclusion of these things. And it's important for any visitor or viewer of photographs of Avebury to recognize that only 10% of the stones erected at Avebury in the 3rd millennium BC are still standing. Almost all were visible in upright or fallen condition in the early 17th century when John Aubrey did an excellent sketch of them. 90% were pulled down and smashed, and nearly all of that 90% in the course of the 17th and 18th century by religious zealots who were inspired by a series of several rectors of St. James Church in the village of Avebury who tended to be Puritans, Church of England clergymen, of course, but of the Puritan variety, who thought a very good thing to do on Sunday was to go out and smash those devil stones and use them for your walls or your barns or things of that sort. It's very sad to walk around Avebury today and see so many of those stones chopped up and, you know, deposited as building material. Interesting kind of thing to do. And it suggests that the Puritan rectors may have thought that there was something distinctly wicked about these stones. And this, of course, adds fuel to the fire of anybody who believes that the purpose of the stones is fertility enhancement. Finally, between 2400 and 2300 BCE, 2 avenues of parallel upright stones were set up coming out from the henge. Some of the stones are still upright in one of these avenues, which connected the henge with the sanctuary, curving from the south bank of the henge southeastward to the sanctuary. Another avenue, which is now entirely destroyed, but which appears in early drawings, and the locations of the stones have been identified by careful archaeology, curves southwestward to an unusual long barrow, now known as the Beckhampton Long Barrow. It's one of the very few long barrows oriented to the northeast, facing roughly the spot on the horizon where the sun rises at midsummer. So this has led astronomical enthusiasts to see astronomical function to Avebury. It hasn't worked out very well. Things just don't measure right. Well, Avebury is a genuinely unique monumental complex, unique in its complexity as well as its size. In a later lecture, I'll tell you about the size. The statistics are absolutely astonishing. But let's try to recap the sequence. First, there were all these long barrows around. Some as far away as Lamburn and Wayland Smithy, many of them quite close, like the Beckhampton Long Barrow, it's about a 5-minute walk from the henge today. Then you get, after about 3,000, they don't build these anymore. Then you get the Causewayed Camps. Then you get the Sanctuary. Then you get Silbury Hill, that extraordinary, unique thing, absolutely astonishing thing. Then you get the Great Henge, and then finally we have these avenues connecting different elements. Extraordinarily complex. None of the rest of these in these other Wessex territories can hold a candle to it. William Stukeley, the eccentric but brilliant 18th century antiquarian, to whom we owe most of our pre-archaeological knowledge of this tragically ruined monument, liked to say that Avebury is to Stonehenge what a cathedral is to a mere chapel, and what a cathedral Avebury actually is, even 90% destroyed as it is today.
Lecture 8, Continental Megalithic Cultures.
Well, now this lecture, I've got to confess, is going to go off on a tangent. But I think that's okay. In fact, necessary. Because the tangent is the term megalithic, what it means, and how it can be applied to this southern British culture, the Windmill Hill culture, the first and probably the most influential of all the Neolithic cultures in Great Britain and possibly in the British Isles as well. We know that its two greatest monuments are Avebury and Stonehenge, and we know that these are always described, and fittingly so, as megalithic monuments. So what does the term megalithic mean? Within what kind of a context of megalithic art should these two great monuments be set? How can we understand them? Lots of cultures throughout the world have adopted a megalithic style of art and or architecture. Easter Island is a prime example. In Western Europe, many Neolithic and later Bronze Age cultures adopted megalithic styles. Spain was the scene of a blended megalithic culture with interesting parallels in Central Europe and eventually the British Isles. Southeastern France is the area of the densest early megalithic tomb construction. Megalithic monuments of every type discussed in this lecture line the Atlantic coast of France. Carnac in Brittany is the site of a monumental complex as great and as complicated as Avebury, in many ways more complicated. The British Isles, in general, are great megalithic sites, and they stretch all the way to Scandinavia. Denmark and southern Sweden are great centers of megalithic art. In these coastal lands, the great stones which gave this widespread style its name were almost certainly used in the development of Neolithic navigation and astronomy. A millennium and a half or so after it got going, in other words, in the 29th or 28th century BCE, the Windmill Hill culture began to use megalithic construction in its cult buildings. Now, megaliths are large stones from the Greek megas, which means big, and lithos, which means stone. Large stones, either standing alone or used as part of a construction involving mostly other large stones. There are some typical megalithic constructions, some terms we must get used to. Menhir, cromlech, and dolmen. All three of these words come from the Breton language. Menhirs are large stones placed upright in the ground, from the Breton words for tall, here, and stone, man. Cromlechs are circles of menhirs, from the Breton word for a necklace. And dolmens are tombs consisting of several upright stones over which large flat stones are laid, from the Breton word for table. Okay. Megalithic construction has been taken up by many cultures throughout the world at various moments in their development and then abandoned. How does this happen? Well, the assumption is that that big stone style is observed by members of a culture which had not used it before and is then imported and imitated more or less exactly and adapted more or less freely. The culture in question may well abandon the megalithic style at some point, and here again, the large stone heads of Easter Island are a splendid example of this kind of tendency. Now, several cultures in Europe, several cultures of Neolithic and Bronze Age Europe, took up megalithic construction in the 3rd and 2nd millennia BCE. In Spain, a new culture was formed by the fusion of such sedentary, probably matriarchal farming peoples as those of the Cueva de los Murciélagos. A fusion of them with pastoral conquerors, cattle-driving nomads who came in from the north. And this fused culture took to erecting large stones as burial monuments and as freestanding sculptures, apparently depicting a goddess with big eyes. I suppose she watched you. This culture also produced a distinctive style of pottery known as bell beakers. Bell beakers, which are very much called that because they're very much the shape of a standard church bell. In the late 3rd millennium BCE, megalithic bell beaker cultures spread northwards. The burial sites, which are mostly dolmens, are, if we look at a map, especially dense along the Atlantic coast, what is today Portugal and northwestern Spain, and it continues along the Atlantic coast of Spain, and then this line of density continues through the Pyrenees. Down in the southeastern part of Spain, there are some extraordinarily magnificent tombs, which are called tholoi, from a Greek word, and they are rounded tombs with a chambered tomb within them, and the chambered tomb is capped by remarkable corbelling, not arching yet, but corbelling. These are very reminiscent of the tombs of Mycenae, of Bronze Age Greece, and the assumption of Child and others was that these great tombs developed in Greece, somewhat possibly influenced by Egyptian models, were then imitated consciously further west in the Mediterranean. Once again, carbon-14 dating has turned that all around, and we know that the tombs at Los Millares in the southeast of Spain are several centuries older than the tombs in Mycenae. So either they were imitated by Eastern Mediterraneans, or these are really spontaneous and separate kind of development. Central Europe was also the home of megalithic bellbeaker cultures, and a fierce dispute currently rages about any possible connections between the Central European and the Spanish megalithic bellbeaker cultures. So Europe is beginning to get covered, you see, with variations of the same kind of thing. You would think that the connection between a certain kind of pot from which one drank beer and large stones of ever-watchful goddesses or burial markers would have little, if anything, to do with each other, but they did. Why exactly is a question which awaits its own exploration. The densest and probably the earliest zone of megalithic construction, mostly as tomb monuments, once again, is southeastern France. From the coastline of the Mediterranean, west from that wonderful Riviera where Nîmes and Agde and Béziers and Narbonne and so on sit, up into the Piedmont of the Cevennes, you can call them mountains if you want. They're really extended hills, it seems to me. One of those departments, the Department of the Aveyron, has over 500 such tombs. Another strictly local feature of these tombs is a carving, usually on one or maybe two of the megaliths of each tomb, of a figure with two eyes and two breasts, holding in presumably her arms, an elongated object which can be understood as a wheat sheaf, an axe, or something like a hockey stick. You are free to do what you wish with this kind of interpretation. Some of the most interestingly varied uses of megalithic construction occurred along the coastlines of Atlantic Europe, not just burial dolmens, but also lots of cromlechs and lots of avenues, straightened out cromlechs, if you want, and just simply upright menhirs, avenues of menhirs, with a purpose that has been argued very seriously is astronomical and for navigational goals. Brittany, the peninsula of Brittany, is unusually rich in megalithic monuments of several kinds, apparently erected as early as the 6th millennium BCE, the 6th millennium, the 5000s. That's astonishing. They get going. Many of these monuments of Brittany may be older than anything down in the southeast of France, in the Aveyron, for example, but that's much disputed for reasons I really won't go into now. Archaeologists working on these Breton sites began the adaptive native interpretation of the spread of Neolithic culture westward, which Alastair Whittle has been the great champion of most recently. Local originality often seems the only way to explain the precocious developments of this area. Our Breton megalithic styles clearly influenced the Windmill Hill culture and other Neolithic cultures in the British Isles. There was an interesting article in an English newspaper a few years ago saying, "The French built Stonehenge," which is the sort of thing that outraged standard public current English sensibility, meaning simply that Breton megalithic styles obviously had a massive influence upon the great late megalithic monument of Stonehenge. Karnak, on the Bay of Quiberon, on the south coast of Brittany, is the site of a monumental complex at least comparable to Avebury, and in several features it shows far greater scientific sophistication. The dolmens of the area, which are scattered around the Bay of the Quiberon Peninsula, reaches out, cutting off a bit of the Atlantic right there, a very shallow part of the Atlantic, which is called the Bay of Quiberon. In the part of the Bay of Quiberon, right up against the beach, known as Carnac Plage, a favorite summer resort place for tired Parisians and other French urbanites, lies the evidence of what must have been a very important maritime city. Carnac has been claimed by some of its enthusiasts as the longest inhabited site in Western Europe. because although what's there now is sort of a spa, kind of a tourist place, a few fishing boats, nothing terribly important, it looks as though habitation has been continuous. And that in the period we're talking about, the megalithic period, the coastline extended considerably further south into this very shallow bay. Unfortunately, the waters of the bay now cover what was probably the settlement area or the warehousing area of this remarkably early great port. Now, the oldest of the dolmens, these dolmens served the same kind of function as the long barrows of southern Britain. And the long barrows of southern Britain in the earlier phases of the Windmill Hill culture were much simpler constructions than dolmens, mostly of earth. Eventually, they became megalithic in having revetments around the side and some big megaliths in the front, in the eastern end of the West Kennet Long Barrow and of Wayland Smithy. But first of all, they were wooden structures. Not here. These dolmens are stone. Usually a dolmen has not just its own table construction with bodies within it, but there's a little bit of an avenue, a little bit of a corridor leaning into it, which is necessary because the dolmen is covered by a large mound. Often a quite perfectly circular mound rising not terribly high, but enough to cover it. Sometimes the earth has been taken away from these dolmens, and we see simply the stones standing up. The bones within are gone. The stones are still there. The surrounding earth has gone. But it hasn't gone from Kerkado. If you want to take a look at a map of the Karnak area, one sees rising up just sort of north of the central area of Karnak Plage, probably fairly due north of the original city, which I at least attribute to the waters in which one goes bathing these days. The oldest of them, Kerkado, appears, according to carefully calibrated carbon-14 dating, to have been used first in 5840 BCE. Now, you've got a right or wrong factor of 300 years there. It might have been as early as 5340, but it might have been as late as 5340, but it might have been earlier than 5840. That's astonishing. To have this kind of construction before much of anything in the way of Neolithic agriculture can have been present in the region. On the island of Gavrinis, to the east of this complex, just to the east of the Bay of Quiberon, is a little inland sea called the Morbihan, which in Breton means the Little Sea. And in this Little Sea, where in fact Julius Caesar fought a very important naval engagement against the great naval power of the people of Karnak, on the island of Gavrinis, in the Bay of Morbihan, just to the east of the Bay of Quiberon, is one of the largest and probably the most richly sculptured chambered tombs in Europe. Many of the stones along the avenue leading into the central chambered tomb have got magnificent carving in them, a relief carving. Not simply one stone with this goddess holding her hockey stick or whatever it is, of the sort you find down in the southeast, but endlessly complicated designs which have been interpreted as representing sails or serpents or axes. Or there's one peculiarly interesting implement there which has been interpreted as a hatchet, or as a peace pipe to smoke something, some kind of interesting herb. Freudian interpretation has seen it as phallic, of course, almost anything would be, but that's a pretty good candidate. It looks to me more like a water pistol than anything else, although it clearly can't have been that. But that's there along with what are thought to be sails and axes and serpents, and clearly some very complicated artistic statement is being made, which has so far, of course, resisted decoding. The most amazing feature of Karnak's megalithic complex, though, is neither the extraordinary early age of the Kerkado dolmen or the extraordinarily sophisticated aesthetic presentation of the Gavrinis dolmen, which is a special kind of dolmen extended out into what was called a chambered tomb. What it is are the alignments of menhirs, which stretch over a mile from a cromlech of huge stones to the southwest, off to the northeast. And there are sort of three sections to this great alignment of stones, and there's another kind of cromlech in the whole process. These alignments were laid out to the north of what I'm convinced must have been this important seaport. They are oriented roughly, sort of, towards the midsummer sunrise position. Alexander Tom, professor of engineering at Oxford University, and as you know, professorships are extremely rare in English universities. Many people whom we would call professors there are called readers or lecturers. Actually, to hold a professorial chair is something. Tom, a very serious engineer, in other words, spent many, many years interpreting these megalithic monuments. And he, working with various astronomers, is convinced that the menhirs are aligned really not so much to mark the place where roughly the sun will rise on Midsummer's Day, but they have to do with lunar calculations, which means that they aren't straight lines, they're kind of curved. Apparently over 10,000 great stones were set up in these parallel rows, 11 parallel rows at one point, that it narrows down to 5 or 6, then it expands again. Most of them are gone, of course. I think something like 3,000 are still upright. They've been used as the stones of Avery were used. And it's very mystifying to see this extraordinary thing. They don't seem to have any burial purpose either. There are dolmens attached along this alignment, but they're not sort of part of the alignment itself. And the astronomical putative purpose is so questionable as to be wide open. So one doesn't really know what they were for. I wonder if perhaps the captain of a vessel who had made a successful trading trip down to Spain or possibly even further, carrying tin from Cornwall around to some Mediterranean, some place where Mediterranean ships could pick up his tin for the great bronze industry that is thriving in the Eastern Mediterranean. We know that this kind of trading was going on around there. If such a captain returning from a particularly successful venture might not decide to have a stone set up to endow a stone in this alignment or whatever its purposes might have been. That's, I suppose, an irresponsible and wildly amateur guess, postulation, but on the other hand, everybody has contributed such wonderful ideas that it's perfectly all right. There is some connection with Midsummer, at least as far as Breton folklore is concerned. The Bretons are a very interesting and stubborn people who maintain their difficult language, their difficult form of the Celtic language, and who maintain remarkable numbers of old traditions. For example, those who think that these menhirs are involved with fertility find Breton folklore, not just Breton folklore, tremendously encouraging. We know from the reports to the bishop of parish priests of the 19th century, Brittany's also been a place producing many, many of the priests of France, a very devoutly pious kind of area, that priests would regularly preach sermons against women of the community going out either at full moons or at midsummer and rubbing themselves without benefit of clothing against these menhirs in order to conceive. Bretons are unhappy if, in 19th century Bretons were unhappy if their families had less than 10 children, and conception was an important point. Well, you don't have to be terribly Freudian, you know, to see the kind of connection right here, which is picked up by people who interpret Avery. People like Keeler, for example, who's sure that those stones had a kind of phallic purpose, which we'll be talking about later. So, we also know from Breton folklore that on Midsummer's Day, all of the 10,000 stones of Karnak, even those that are no longer there, will race down to the plage and go for a swim. And while they are gone, if you're careful, you will look into the socket holes where they're set up, and you will see a golden treasure. And you can take some of it, but don't be greedy, because they come back in extraordinarily nanosecond speed and crush the greedy within these tombs, which helps explain a few of the skeletons that have been found. Well, what to do with this, I don't know. It's obviously very complicated. We have no less than an Oxford professor of engineering discovering remarkable astronomical purposes for these things. We have Freudian purposes. We have all of these other stories. Perhaps if the Freudian purpose is correct, then there is no fertility monument in the world, not even those extraordinary erotic temples of India, which is comparable to Karnak. This is a great riddle that begs to be solved. And many fine minds have put their best energies in trying to solve this riddle without any at all satisfactory solutions so far. Unfortunately, as Aubrey Burl himself has remarked, as the great R.J.C. Atkinson, the main excavator of Stonehenge, remarked years ago, we will never know exactly what the purpose of these structures was because they were not written down. Such is the importance of writing. Well, even more interesting than the alignments, it seems to me, are several of the extraordinarily tall menhirs. The tallest menhir of all is the thing called on most maps Le Grand Menhir, which is French. Bretons insist it should be called Ergrach, which is the proper Breton way to say the same thing. Ergrach was 60 feet tall, a little bit over 60 feet. Nowhere in the world is there a except of course, unless you want to consider Egyptian obelisks of a later period, as menhirs. No, except for them, there is nothing like it anywhere in the world. What on earth was it for? And those of you who have a chance to look at a map in any of the standard guidebooks will notice that the Grand Menhir has been connected with other lesser menhirs, any other menhir is lesser, by Tom, in a very interesting kind of pattern. he's convinced that it was the center of what is, frankly, a lunar observatory, which was able to predict a number of lunar movements. The maximum midwinter moonset, the minimum midwinter moonset, and so on, could be tracked out. There are six lines of connection lining up a menhir on one side, a dolmen on another side, the line of sight passing right through the great menhir, or then two menhirs or two dolmens or whatever. I don't know how many of us are familiar with the terms maximum and minimum moonsets, midwinter, midsummer, whatever. I think we're all aware that, especially in those northern latitudes, the moon rises and sets and moves around at different altitudes above the horizon of the Earth, unlike the sun. So when the moon is at its highest, then you want to see where it rises and where it sets. When it's at its lowest, and up in the islands of the Orkneys, for example, to the north of Scotland, the moon appears sometimes never really to set, but simply to move along the horizon, the flat horizon of the ocean. So the moon is much more variable than the sun, and much more difficult to figure out. And there are cycles between maximum and minimum moonrise and moonset, especially if you're calculating them by midsummer and midwinter, cycles of precisely 18.61 years. Now, Tom went to work measuring endlessly the distance between these megaliths, and even before there were computers, he put all of his measurements together, he crunched them together, and he came up with a unit called the megalithic yard, which he decided was the unit of measurement used in Brittany, in the British Isles, even in some of the dolmens and menhirs of Scandinavia. And then he also was able to align these astronomical calculations with much of the other data which his inexhaustible team collected. Another value of the great menhir was clearly navigational. If you were hoving into the Bay of Quiberon, whatever they called it in those days, it was very valuable to be able to see that you're on the line between several of those great menhirs out of the south of the Quiberon Peninsula and the great menhir. You would know exactly where you were. In fact, the navigational value of the great menhir was remarked by a French ship commander, member of the French Navy, as recently as 1659 CE. Another local reported that in the year 1727 he had seen this great menhir fallen, and it is today fallen. It broke into three drastic pieces. And everyone is convinced, practically everyone is convinced, that was just, it was obviously a lightning rod. It was tremendously vulnerable to lightning at that elevation. It could have been some kind of an earthquake. Who knows? However, a new theory proposed by the brilliant professor of such things at the University of Rennes in Brittany, Rennes, as they say in Breton, is convinced that this is one of several broken menhirs which were designed to be broken. That whatever tall menhir the French sea captain was talking about in 1659 was one of several others, which this professor is convinced would have served better navigational purposes. His name is Lelguach, a wonderful Breton name again, and he's written a brilliant book, Les Menhirs Brisés, Les Dieux Qu'on Brise, about the gods which one breaks, that these menhirs represent gods who are offered up in broken portions, or perhaps are broken in order to keep control of them, or any rate. But this is a work of immense erudition, as well as a very interesting, very, very surgically precise theory. So, I hope this gives you some idea of what menhirs and other dolmens can do. What megalithic construction, difficult as it was in that simple time to set up, any of the stones set up in anywhere in the British Isles like this were very difficult to raise, to socket, and to put in any kind of a direct, straight alignment, an extraordinary challenge indeed. They all pale beside the extraordinary Karnak complex. Karnak, Avery, Stonehenge, monuments of remarkable complexity, which challenged the imagination of modern heirs of that culture to figure out what the forebears were up to when they spent so much time and so much energy doing these things. Well, the Irish Sea is a great center of megalithic construction. On the eastern side, on the side of Great Britain, there's so many of them. Let me just mention Long Meg and her daughters, Castle Rigg and Callanish, extraordinary ones. Long Meg and her daughters is in Cumberland, that northwestmost county of England. is Castle Rigg. Long Meg and her daughters is a huge flattened circle, very clumsily made. People obviously didn't have much sense of a circle, although some have tried to give astronomical significance to these flattened circles as well. Its diameter is 111 yards at its widest and 94 at its narrowest. Aubrey Burl, interpreting it, guesses that it was the ritual center of a Neolithic community of maybe 250 to 400 people. He's a master of demographic figures, and I think figures like that of his ought to be taken with much respect. He surmises that it was set up for fertility dances rather than any astronomical calculation. That was the function of this megalithic monument. He decides a lot of this on the basis of analogy. He's very interested in the fertility dances of American Plains Indians, for example. And he sees a connection, imagining that the ancient British were doing very much the same kind of thing. Castle Rigg, also in Cumberland, is one of the best preserved of these great stone circles. These are cromlechs, in other words. And it's got in the middle of it a rectangular stone structure, not the middle, but at an interesting place in it, a rectangular stone enclosure, which has received much speculation. Even Burl, who's very skeptical of astronomical purposes for these megalithic monuments, points out that the largest menhir in the circle, some 7 feet tall, seems to be aligned with the point on the horizon at which the sun rises, not at midsummer or midwinter, but at the equinoxes of fall and spring. If Burl will admit so much, it's something to think about, I think. Scotland is quite rich in such sites, especially on outer islands such as the Hebrides and the Orkneys. Callanish, on the island of Lewis, is quite remarkable. Lewis is in the Outer Hebrides. It is a dolmen set within a cromlech, which is linked to 4 avenues of parallel menhirs. We've got all 3 of these basic megalithic types: dolmen, cromlech, and menhir. And the orientation of the avenues has been explained by Tom as a lunar observatory, which also pointed to the point on the horizon where a key navigational star arose at 2700 BCE. Now, of course, these navigational stars, points of rising and so on, have changed a little bit. And Tom is one of those who uses these star charts to date the construction of these extraordinary monuments, operating, of course, on the hypothesis that they're pointing, they have to point to something. What can you see that they point to? Well, they point to the point at which star X came above the horizon at a certain date, and so that must be the date of the whole monument. Obviously, these are hypothetical structures, but then so is most of science. Nothing different about that. Ireland has megalithic monuments, large and small. The hinges of Ireland are sometimes thought to be a sign of British Neolithic influence, British Neolithic culture exercising its influence across the Irish Sea. They cluster, as of France, in the southwest and the northwest, the old home of Munster, Iron Age Celtic knowledge throughout the Middle Ages. The north of the Ulster is beset as we've been through all of its history by cultural and military nastiness. These areas where mythic circles, where mythic megalithic actions are particularly powerful circles, lines, and dolmens, menhirs, the works. They're also the 2 areas of historic Ireland in which, until modern times, Irish political power, economic activity, and so on concentrated. Now, Dublin is not in either Ulster or Munster. But until the importance of Dublin, a foreign city founded by Vikings, taken over by the English, the center of the English Pale, until that foreign influence came in, it was Ulster and Munster, Tara and Cashel, which were the sources of Irish creativity, economic, poetic, all the rest of it. That they should be particularly dense in megalithic monuments is no accident. Now, very few of the Irish stone circles or henges have the kind of dimensions of the greatest English or Scottish megalithic monuments, but archaeologists have recently found in Ireland the earliest known stone enclosure in Europe, which seems to date from the Mesolithic era, pre-Neolithic. Astonishing. Which might lead one to prison in Ireland, spread elsewhere, and come back. That is, if you're a diffusionist, if you think ideas like this, inspiring human constructions, have to start somewhere and be diffused outward and so on. But if you're not a diffusionist, if you think people in different places and have common ideas responding to certain to comparable circumstances, then it makes a lot less tricky. And of course, the greatest of the chambered tombs, very good in design, but extraordinary in size, in shape, in conception, in astronomical vision, is the great tomb of Newhenge, which is located with some such great chambered tombs at the bend of the River Boyne, very close to the site of with chambered tombs at the bend of the River Boyne, close to the site of Tara, which was the sacred ritual seat of the Highs of Ireland. It has recently restored, but had to restore the extraordinary slit in the western end, through which, or in the eastern end, through which the midwinter sun rose. The sun at midwinter rises, and for about 20 minutes, the light through this slit is cast upon an extraordinarily compelling piece of relief on one of the great stones. This is obviously not accidental, and it shows a kind of astronomical precision that is most impressive indeed. What about England? Well, I've mentioned northern England already, Cumberland. The whole point of this tangent was to give us a kind of frame, a kind of a context for the great megalithic monuments of the south of England put up during the Windmill Hill culture and its offspring, the Wessex culture. Avery, of course, is the most massive megalithic monument in Britain, in the British Isles. Stonehenge is by far the most sophisticated. But we should remember that even earlier than those two great henges of the Windmill Hill culture, the Long Barrow of Wayland Smithy, built for the first time around 3700 BCE, was redesigned and greatly expanded about 3400 BCE by a revetment of local sourcing stones, and also by a burial chamber, which is faced with stone, which makes it one of the earliest megalithic monuments of the Windmill Hill culture, a true predecessor to the astonishing things that would be done at Avebury and later on at Stonehenge.